I've been asked to talk about new weapons and proliferation. The link between nuclear weapons and civilian nuclear power, of course, has been there from the very beginning. And I dare say it's becoming, in the past it was, in a sense, nuclear weapons which drove civilian nuclear power. I think we're finding on the international scene that civilian nuclear power may be, in a way, driving nuclear weapons. So I want to talk a little bit about what we're up against now. We have a lot of old weapons sitting around. The legacy from the Cold War is really stunning. Since 1987, when the United States and the Soviet Union reached a peak of 70,000 nuclear weapons altogether, we've reduced that to about 19,000, according to the Nuclear Notebook, which the Bulletin publishes every couple of months. 19,000 are deployed and stored nuclear weapons between mostly Russia and the United States. Now, in the last 25 years, then, we've made a lot of progress. The Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, a program which brought the U.S. and Russian scientists and engineers together, have dismantled a lot of those nuclear weapons, and we've stored many in arsenals. Part of the problem, though, we have is what to do with the dismantled nuclear material. Where are we going to store it? Where's the waste? Bob Alvarez is absolutely right. That's the military programs, which are really presenting the problems of waste storage. And with the ratification of the New START Treaty in 2010, we're continuing to reduce those numbers, and that's good news. That's very good news. The problem, of course, is that we've got more waste to deal with. I think this next administration, the next Obama administration, will likely come to an agreement with the Russians about continued work on joint dismantlement of these weapons, and I think there'll be continued unilateral moves, informal reductions, maybe not treaty-based, but the Russians certainly would like to reduce their arsenals, and in fact, our military would like to reduce our arsenals, especially with the budget crunch that is coming along. There are also, though, stores of new fissile material, material that is nuclear that can be used for bombs. That's what fissile material means. It's nuclear bomb-making material. We haven't really come to a good closure on that. There's been an idea for a fissile material cutoff treaty. Don't you love the way people talk about this stuff? And maybe it's because it's such an awkward title for a treaty, but in any event, we haven't gotten very far. Currently, the Pakistanis are holding it up. We've held it up. The Chinese have held it up. The point is, nobody wants to stop making this stuff quite yet. Obama did, in his last 4 years, come up with the idea of a nuclear security summit. We've had two of them, one in 2010 and one in 2012, where we've asked heads of state, he's asked heads of state to come and talk about the need to secure all nuclear fissile material. That is highly enriched uranium that may be still being used in nuclear power plants. There are some of those. Also, research reactors. There are 140 sites around the world, I think someone mentioned earlier, 140 sites around the world where we have fissile material. There's a research reactor in Nigeria that I was shown with great pride when I went to visit Nigeria. There have been in the Congo. There are really all over the world from this Atoms for Peace program. So we've got this stuff just fairly all over the world. So we talk about the United States, and we have focused a lot on the United States, which is a great place to start. But we also need to think about what's happening in the rest of the world. And what's happening in the rest of the world is not exactly a great sight. The Russians are enriching highly enriched uranium again for their nuclear-powered submarines. And you heard just a minute ago about Norway using those nuclear-powered submarines in the Arctic. The Arctic is a great place. It's opening up from climate change, and there are more submarines and more patrols going on in that Arctic. And that's where a lot of the Russian submarines hang out, shall I say. Pakistan is enriching uranium to build more weapons itself. It seems to be on a weapons race. And the U.S. is modernizing its own weapons, although the idea of getting new plutonium pits for our modernized nuclear weapons seems to be running into trouble. So that's great, and we need to work harder on it. China is modernizing its weapons, though its policy of minimum deterrence with its warheads decoupled, I think, means it won't be a huge driver of that. So we've got weapons being built and more of them being built, nuclear submarines. We've got lots of military uses still for this stuff, as well as the civilian reactors. So I think it's good to be mindful of that as also part of the drawdown, if I can speak of a drawdown, of nuclear material. And it's the fissile material that I still think is the most dangerous, both because it can be used in bombs and because in plutonium, it's very dangerous stuff. Highly enriched uranium is, you know, extremely toxic. And I think Bob Alvarez and others have shown how that's the case. There are some new potential capacities that are developing, and I want to mention two. One is the small modular reactors, and we can talk more about that. The other is the new laser enrichment process for enriching uranium called Silex. It's less costly than the centrifuges. It uses less electricity to enrich. And it also gives off fewer chemicals, so it's less easy to detect. So if you put that all together, there's a much greater risk of proliferation of all kinds of nuclear material, whether it's low-enriched uranium or high-enriched uranium. And if you've got treaties where you want to verify stuff, Silex makes it much tougher. And yet the United States has, in its infinite wisdom, developed this technology. And even though it doesn't really need this capacity, it's been wanting to develop it so that it essentially can export it. It's been talking to Japanese, for instance, about whether they wouldn't be interested in coming in on this new kind of enrichment facility. Again, Scott Kemp in July in the Bulletin has written a very nice article on Silex, which I think puts it all together for you. A Silex plant would be 75% smaller than a regular nuclear centrifuge plant. So it makes it much easier for, say, another country like perhaps copying Iran to make enriched uranium, and it takes a much shorter time for the Silex process to get from low-enriched to high-enriched uranium. So it's something that, again, we've developed as part of our policy, which really doesn't have much use, and we need to keep paying attention. The small modular reactors we've talked about a little bit. Again, this is something that can be is a proliferation problem, I think we can certainly come back to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has just chosen Babcock Wilson to put in. Wilcox. Sorry, has been chosen to put a plant in Clinch River, Tennessee. Babcock Wilcox, as I recall, is the very same. A company that provided the security at the Y-12 plant that was broken into by the nun and her two accomplices. So go figure. I don't know quite about that or what's happening there. So what I really want to close with and emphasize is that the new nuclear power plants that countries are interested in developing, and China certainly is going ahead substantially. It needs huge energy sources. It's also going ahead with solar and wind and geothermal and coal. It's doing everything because it really needs energy, they think, to bring their vast population out of poverty and into a better standard of living. The most recent agreements, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, has signed an agreement to have a power plant built there. It's signed an agreement. They say they won't enrich uranium. So at least somebody else, not the UAE, has control. But Vietnam has also signed a contract, this one, I believe, with South Korea for its first nuclear power plant. But it doesn't have this agreement to relinquish the right to fuel enrichment. Now, the reason this is a problem, as you know from reading about Iran, is that if you can enrich uranium for a power plant, you can also use the same technology to enrich it to make nuclear weapons. And the two motivators for getting nuclear power now are energy sources, and you know, climate change is being used as a reason why nuclear is better than coal or oil or other things. But the other is because we think a lot of countries want to use it as a hedge. They want to have the capacity to have a nuclear weapon. It's still a motivating force. It's still something that drives countries. Vietnam is on the border of China. There's no love lost between those two countries. We have not been able to successfully convince people and to provide the incentives for them to turn away from nuclear weapons. So in summary, let me just kind of say, putting this all together, that the age of arms control and nuclear weapons reductions, as well as the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, has, I think, been somewhat supplanted by an age of civilian nuclear power, starting with nuclear power and then acquiring the uranium enrichment as a hedge so that you can make nuclear weapons. So the rules that have been brought, that have been put in place, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, have been somewhat effective, but the rules are not enough. And I think one of the things in the arms control community that we have not really fully come to grips with is that it's nice to have laws and treaties and all that kind of stuff, but if you don't find the incentives to get people to do what the rules are telling you to do, there are always going to be people who want to break out. There are always going to be cheaters. There are always going to be people who want to, somehow get underneath the radar screen. And certainly the U.S. has been one of the big rule breakers. Let's be fair about that. So with the ability to pursue this kind of ambiguous policy, you know, do you really want a nuclear weapon or not? Well, we're not quite sure. But the pursuit of civilian nuclear power then becomes a path to making a bomb. And I think in that case, the world still obviously faces peril from the spread of this most dangerous technology on Earth and the fire that won't go out. In terms of things to do, I think there are probably a couple. One is just get smart and stay smart. And I know you people in this room are smart, and I hope you'll continue to look for sites. I'll plug the bulletin again, but you know, Steve Schwartz is here to tell you that it's the best damn magazine on Earth, except for Nonproliferation Review, which he now edits. But it's done. It's really meant for people who don't know nuke speak. It's the whole idea is to get it into language without using acronyms. And I think there may be, and this is a smaller piece, I don't know this for sure, but the new chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Allison McFarlane, and we've cast great aspersions on the NRC today, and probably with good cause. Allison comes at the job, she was actually on our board of the bulletin, she comes to the job as a geologist, very skeptical about the ability to adequately store the material from spent fuel, and has questioned many times. She's a leading expert on Yucca Mountain. She wrote a terrific book on it. And I think as much as we want to attack the NRC, we may actually have a friend there. And if there's any way that we can make use of her position, doesn't mean we kind of pander to her, but rather, as FDR said, you know, I agree with you 100%, now go out and make me do it. And I think Allison's in a position, meaning, you know, make a lot of fuss, put a lot of pressure, but I think she's sympathetic to some of what you all are about and we're about. So I'd suggest that this is really an opportune moment to pursue an anti-nuclear power, certainly an anti-nuclear weapon agenda. Thanks very much, and we'll take questions.
I would like to take you up on that last point. Allison McFarlane is now the chair of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Yesterday, November 30th, the NRC staff wrote to the commission asking them to put filters on the containment vents. These weak, you know, the Mark I containment is bound to fail. It was demonstrated at Fukushima, but we knew about it since 1972, that if it had an accident, it was going to fail. In order to provide, you know, the continued operation of these failed containments, they decided that they could put vents on them. That didn't work. But now the staff has arrived at saying, well, if we're going to let these things continue to operate, we better put radiation filters on those vents that we backfitted them with. That went to the commission yesterday. The industry is going to oppose that. No question. No question. What's interesting is that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, published in 1982, Frank von Hippel and Jan Bie wrote an article, said, you ought to put vents on these Mark I's. Okay? So, frankly, the Bulletin is now in a very good position to call upon Allison, in her position, in her prestigious position as chair, with a copy of the Bulletin from 1982, and said, your staff is now recommending this.
30 years later,
after the NRC dissed these guys in 1982. So if there is an opportunity for reflection on change, illuminated by Fukushima, we need reasonable people. And I believe you. I've met Allison a number of times. She's reasonable. But again, she's in the context of regulatory capture. And it's a 5-member commission. And the last one that bucked the commission, they rode him out on a rail. And that's the dilemma. And Allison, you know, God bless her, she has put herself in the jaws of the beast. But she needs support. And I think the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is in a very good position right now to, you know, I think that didn't Frank write a review in the Bulletin just months after the last, after the accident in 2011? But the thing that I wanted to just put back before you, and you know, if you have comment, I'm certainly interested. The NRC staff yesterday agreed with Jan and the Bulletin from 1982.
Is somebody going to respond?
Oh, well, I didn't realize I needed to respond. You don't need to, only if you want to.
Okay, well, I think the Europeans, after that article was published, actually, Frank von Hippel and Jan Bay's piece, the Europeans did put filters on the what are they called? Yeah, the Mark I, but the yeah, on the so yes, they did, and our nuclear industry said, well, it would be too expensive, so cost, you know, always seems to, the short term, you know, kind of drives out the long term greater good in some ways. I think, you know, yes, Allison is one person, and as much as she is a skeptic you're right, she's going to be under a lot of different kinds of pressure. It's great that they're, you know, her staff has recommended this, but you're absolutely right, the nuclear industry is you know, it's under even more cost pressure than it was in those days, so, you know, who knows what's going to happen. I think from just knowing Allison for, you know, a bit, she's somebody who I think will listen to a whole range of people. When she was on the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future, you know, one of the recommendations that came out of that was to involve the public much more in all of this. You know, they came and said, look, the storage problem is not a technical problem. It's a political problem. And the way that we go about talking and informing and engaging people in these questions, I mean, we're going to have to store, is important. We're going to have to, you know, if we shut all the reactors down tomorrow, we still have the problem of waste. So how do we deal with this? And is it, you know, it can be done, but we've got to find ways to involve people so they understand the costs and the benefits. We don't want it sitting out forever, I don't think. It's a horrible problem, and we're going to have more of it if we dismantle nuclear weapons. So the question is, how can we reasonably, you know, go forward? And I think, but I do think we have a bit of an opportunity here. You know, it would be worth talking strategy, I think.
I'd like to ask Arne Gunterson, do you think that today's NRC staff is any more tolerant of whistleblowers today at nuclear power plants than in the past?
No.
Is there any hope?
You know, I was... you can apply to be on the Advisory Committee for Reactor Safeguard. So I did. I've done 3 times, and I've been rejected 3 times. And the last time, though, I heard a conversation out of... I guess by then I'd gotten hearing aids. I could hear them a little better. And I was, you know, I was invited to these 17 guys to talk about my credentials, and there was 10 of us, and there was 2 openings, so I thought I had a 20% chance. So I said, you know, I represent NGOs. And behind, there was this little stage whisper, "That's a nice word for them."
That's so a nice word.
I think it infuses.
I need a hearing aid. What is it?
That's a nice word for them.
Oh,
is what
the
they
NGO.
What I heard, and you know, so they, it is them and the anti-nukes, and yeah, you've crossed the line, and there's no going back. And I truly believe that the staff is captured, especially I think that at the worker bee level. There's good staffers, but as you work your way up in management, the higher up in management you go, the more co-opted you are by the industry.
Because there's really a wonderful whistleblower, Larry Crishone, who's at the NRC on the staff now. And
I get calls from whistleblowers, and my first reaction is don't do it. And the second reaction is get a job before you do it. And the third reaction is if you've already done it, oh boy, get a good lawyer. But it's not the process, the whistleblowing process is not user friendly.
Hello, my name is Patricia Axelrod. I conduct the Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate. Before I pose my question, and or make a comment, I would like to introduce you folks, if you don't know, this good woman, Ellen Thomas, who's right over there. She runs Proposition 1 campaign for global nuclear disarmament and energy conversion. She's been working on this 30 years to try to bring about a nuclear-free world. So I want to acknowledge her. She really is a stupendous woman. And furthermore, I'd like to honor Dr. Theodore B. Taylor, who, if he were alive, would be with us tonight. He was my friend and my mentor and a man of extraordinary intellect and brilliance and kindness and compassion. So I just want to say, Dr. Taylor, presente, as we used to say about, you know, in that movement as we struggled against the struggles in Central America. But with that said, I take note, Kenneth, Ms. Benedict, that the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, this is dedicated to the risks of exposure to low-level radiation. And I'm primarily in some great measure concerned about veterans and about their exposures to what is euphemistically referred to as DU, something I'd rather call radioactive weaponry. And while the Department of Death, or DOD, whatever you want to call them, Department of Defense, if they will acknowledge at all a health effect, generally they will dismiss it by stating, ah, it's a low-level effect, therefore it has no consequence. And so, and I am very well informed. I'm bi-coastal, I'm in Nevada, and I'm in Illinois. I'm very well informed about what's going on at the Nevada test site, which is a repository for low-level and bomb-grade nuclear waste. And I wonder if you could just very briefly give me a synopsis. Very briefly. If you could define low-level radiation, very briefly, I know what it is, but for those who don't know, if you'd be so kind.
Well, I think I should bring Arjun up here if he's still here. I mean, there is no safe level of, exposure to radioactivity. And I think the National Academy of Sciences has, over several reports, suggested as much. It's always a matter of cost-benefit. Mammogram, I get much more exposure from that than from hanging around a nuclear power plant. But I'm willing to go through that in order to for health reasons. Dental X-rays the same. So I think yes, low-level radiation is something to be concerned about. But with all of these technologies in general, these are complicated things, and we need to be thinking about what the harm is, as well as and the benefits. And for each of us, if it's an individual thing, then we make that determination. The problem is when it comes to a public exposure to low-level radiation, and I think that's where it's even more difficult because it's not something you can control necessarily. And it's something that it's hard to get a grip on. So that, the issue that we did in the bulletin was an attempt to try to tease out, untangle some of the complexities of the issue. I will say, we are often sometimes called the voice of reason. Sometimes we're not called that at all. But I will comment that I got two responses, several, but two in particular that I remember. One saying, "Well, I've read this bulletin issue, and it's really terrific, and it's clear that we just, there's just no safe level for this stuff, and we should get rid of all of it." And the other one was, "This is a great issue, and well, I guess we just don't have anything to worry about." So it tries to inform you. So be informed.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm John Bolenbaugh, and I'm a whistleblower for tar sand oil. I have turned into an activist now and a reporter, and I make videos, and they're becoming worldwide slowly. But now I'm having whistleblowers contact me, one from a nuclear power plant in Michigan. I can't say which one, but I'm about ready to make some major videos of some major government cover-ups. And, I'm excited. So I came here to learn more about this, but I'm living an Aaron Brockovich situation in Michigan. We have hundreds of sick people, and they're getting sicker all the time with seizures. People have died. Cancer's on the rise. We had 40 miles of river that was contaminated. And it's important for you people here in Chicago because they lied to you, and the toxic chemicals made it to the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan, and that's where your fresh water comes from. That's what you drink from. Mm-hmm. And so I want to know, because I heard today that it's radioactive, the bottom of our river is still full of oil, and I've already, from my videos, made them clean up over $100 million extra after they said a year and a half ago it was 100% clean from my videos. So can you tell me, thank you, can you tell me how radioactive tar sand oil is? I need to learn more about that, either from you or somebody later tonight that's in the audience.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm sure somebody heard me, so just approach me later.
On the whistleblower thing, two thoughts. Be very careful not to fingerprint the person. And even if you take their name off the file, that doesn't mean that there can't be retribution. I had a case where I made a mistake. A whistleblower contacted me. I totally sanitized the information, and I gave it to the NRC through a, I always go, my wife's advice here is right on the money. Don't go directly to the NRC. Go to Congress and then have them give it to the NRC. It's more protection for you, and it also is likely to get results. But anyway, so I did that. And I gave them three concerns, and each concern was sanitized. The NRC took the three concerns and gave them to Oyster Creek. And there's only one, even though each concern was sanitized and there was no fingerprint, there was only one person who could have done all three of those, and there was retribution. So, and of course, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is really not interested in protecting that person either. So just please be very careful you don't inadvertently jeopardize a person's career, his family, and stuff like that.
Right. When I reported the cover-up that they were burying oil instead of cleaning it up to save money, I was fired the next day. And so I won my lawsuit. Yeah. And but this whistleblower that I'm talking about, I don't know what to do. He's scared for his life, for real. Well, I've had four death threats and slashed tires and cut brakes and everything already.
Yeah. POGO in Washington, and there's also a couple others, POGO,
Program on Government Oversight.
Can help whistleblowers. That would be one I'd go to. There's also a couple others down there too, but POGO comes to mind.
So I shouldn't just go through an attorney?
Well, they would line the person up with an attorney, or if you called on the person's behalf, whatever. But they're pretty good at not fingerprinting people, and they're also they know how to work the bureaucracy.
Yeah. All right, thank you, sir.
Yeah. You know, I have one thought on your question about whistleblowers again. When I blew the whistle, my wife and I went to the legislature in Connecticut and tried to pass a whistleblower protection law. And the first year we lost. You know, Northeast Utilities just overwhelmed us. But we it was okay because we educated a bunch of senators. The second year, we thought we won. And we had a great bill. This is in Northeast, in Connecticut. And there was honest protection for the whistleblowers. But behind the scenes, Northeast Utilities took the funding away. So it's not, you have to, as you're from the person on the staff who was supposed to be doing whistleblower protection, they just eliminated the funding from that slot. So we lost, we thought we won and we lost. It's not, making a presentation in a state house is not enough. You really need a presence in a state house. The groups in Connecticut, in Vermont rather, have a full-time lobbyist, and it took 3 years for what happened in Vermont. So one of the things I learned at the state level is you need a presence. When you walk out of the room, the lobbyists for the other side do not.
I really believe you need bodyguards. I think that's the only protection. And anytime I go do investigative work, I have people that come with me now. So
yeah.
It's scary.
Hi, I'm Beverly Walter, a local activist. My question is about the Soviet Union. And after the former Soviet Union was dissolved, it was broke. And so they sold a lot of their weapons. And a lot of those apparently ended up in some kind of rogue nations that used to be a part of the Soviet Union, I think including a republic now called Moldavia, which is down close to Romania and close to the Crimea. And this is quite a rogue nation. There have been books written about it. And it is selling those weapons in a kind of a black market criminal fashion. I'm just wondering if you're aware of that and if you think that maybe any nuclear weapons have leaked out into the criminal element, the worldwide criminal element, because apparently it's getting stronger and stronger.
I'm not aware of the these are conventional weapons that have gone to Moldavia.
They're weapons. I don't know if there were any nuclear weapons or not. That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, I don't. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, We worked very diligently with the countries which were the inheritors of those weapons, Belarus, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, and in fact were able to move those weapons back to Russia. Through another several different efforts have managed to move much of the fissile material out of those countries. So I don't, yes, the Soviet Union, Russia was broke, and that's in fact why Senators Nunn and Lugar put in place the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, because they knew it would be difficult for them to dismantle and secure, and their horror stories about where the material was kept, and with just a padlock, for instance. So over the last 25 years have managed to secure something like 80 or 90% of the Soviet or the former Soviet arsenals and material. The IAEA does track traffic in fissile material, either highly enriched uranium or plutonium, and there have been certainly a number of incidents, and it is scary. And that's why we have worked hard to get Congress to continue to fund these programs so that they won't. But I'm not aware of, there have been sting operations, and there has been material that has been picked up, but I don't believe that the kind of large-scale operation you're talking about, I haven't heard about it.
Thanks.
And one thing, I agree, there's no, I don't believe there's any missing nukes. There are some handheld weapons, conventional weapons, that could poke the hole in the side of a BWR fuel pool like Dresden and cause it to have a meltdown. So the conventional weapons are out there, and we as a country have discounted the terrorist threat issue.
But it's also the case that the U.S. is the greatest manufacturer, the largest manufacturer of convention of handheld any kind of weapon. So it's ours. They're ours.
Thanks.
Hi. Thank you both for being here. My name is Gail Vaughn, and you had said, I believe you were quoting the NRC chairman, that the storage of the nuclear waste was not a technical problem but a political problem. Maybe I misheard you, but
no,
something like
that.
Well, I'm not so sure that I agree with that. I think that it's still something of a technical problem, and I wanted to know if anyone here has any idea of what we should be doing with all of the stuff that we can more or less secure, the spent fuel rods, the fissile material, the former bombs, much less the stuff that's out of control already, like Hanford and Savannah River and Fukushima. That's my question. Any ideas?
Well,
what are we going to do with it?
I'll just quickly, I'm not an expert, I leverage my ignorance and try and listen to other people and try and put it all together. But my understanding from the folks that I talk to at the Bulletin and other places is that, we do have to do something with it, right? Okay, let's stipulate that. Right now, the dry cask storage, as I understand it, has a possibility, and you'll talk to the expert in a minute, but I think what Allison was referring to was that the dry cask storage seems to be sufficient for now. It's better than leaving it in pools, open pools. And I think her suggestion is that Yucca Mountain may not be at all a good place from a geologist's point of view, but she suggests that there are places in the United States where if you're looking for a permanent repository, actually Illinois wouldn't be bad because if you look at the geology right now, there isn't much seismic activity. All I'm saying is that, we chose the West because that's where the weapons had gone off and people were used to dealing with the stuff. The point is we need to find a solution to it. And so, well, I've given you the ideas that I know about.
And we will be discussing that tomorrow as well.
Okay, good.
Okay, yeah. When you find yourself in a hole, the best thing to do is to stop digging. So building more or running them longer creates more of the waste that we still don't know what to do with. And that's, I think, important. The dry casks, seem to be what we'll be stuck with for 50 years or more. Whether or not to keep those on the sites or to consolidate them is a separate issue. But getting the material out of these fuel pools It would be to avoid a problem like Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4, which is all the fuel is in the pool, there's nothing in the reactor, and still the thing exploded. We've got to get the fuel out of the fuel pools. And so our first priority has got to be to get it to dry cask. And on Yucca was, you know, it was chosen politically despite the science. And so people will say, well, you know, this is a political thing, and actually the science supports Yucca. No, it was the other way around. Yucca, the bill was originally called, to use the polite term, the Screw Nevada Act. And so Yucca may not be the right one, but somebody's got to take it sometime. But first, you got to stop digging.
I just wanted to talk about the last time I heard Jeff Patterson speak. He talked a lot about Alice Stewart, who was the person who did the original research on low-level radiation and its effect on the human body. And she said, I read a little bit of some of the things she said, and one of them was that if a pregnant woman gets a tooth x-ray, that there's a certain percentage higher rate of leukemia in the offspring of a woman who has this while she's pregnant. And but I just wanted to put out the name Alice Stewart to answer some of the questions about the effects of low-level radiation on the human body. I Googled it, and it worked. You can find it.
You can find Alice Stewart's work in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and the archives are on Google Books if you want to look it up.
My name is Cindy, but just to follow up on that, there's a book called The Woman Who Knew Too Much that was written about Alice Stewart. It's her whole life. It's fantastic. I just wanted to mention that we've been talking about accidents. We haven't talked about waste accidents, starting way back with Chalk River. And then with Windscale in England, it was so critical. This plant blew up that it was like a mini Chernobyl. All the milk and vegetables had to...
Windscale reactor.
Yeah, but it blew up. Yes, but then it was so bad that when they started reprocessing, which is one of the dirtiest places in the whole world, and it hasn't been mentioned much once today, Sellafield, which is making a reprocessing, they had to change the name from Windscale to Sellafield, but it's the same place, because they're very good at name changing when you have an accident. Not to mention in 1957, Christom, there have been three huge accidents in Euro-Russia. One was Christom, I can't pronounce it very well, but one, they had all the waste in a lake, and the lake dried up, and the whole place just, there were three of them, not just one, nuclear waste accidents. Not to mention Laguna down in Veracruz, Mexico, where they have these nukes on the beach, and they're very bad in third world countries because they just dump the waste on the beach. I could go on and on, but I think we have to realize the seriousness of keeping these wastes in the future. And one question, what's the name of the plant that's going to shut down this year? Kendra mentioned it.
Next year.
I heard a plant was going to...
What? Kewaunee. The Kewaunee plant in Wisconsin is... It's a 600 megawatt plant. It's a single unit plant, and the owner of the plant has decided that it makes no economic sense to run it. So it'll be shutting down in. We've said on a couple of the latest Fairwinds podcasts, we talk about that. The dominoes are starting to fall. These small single unit reactors, like Oyster Creek, the Vermont Yankee, and others. The commercial pressures on them to keep them running, especially in light of Fukushima modifications, I don't think Kewaunee will be the only plant to shut down. I think we'll see quite a few.
Also, I'd like to add that Canada, Quebec's only reactor, Gentilly, is shutting down by the end of 2012.
Yeah.
And that was new. That was a political decision made by the new provincial government.
Hi, I'm Kevin Cotis from Muskegon, Michigan, and I think that we should at least address, I mean, as a peace-loving person, we should at least address the fact that we have to stop consuming so much. We have to demand more conservation of energy and not be lured and misled by the energy industry that we need more and more and more energy. Until we change our own behavior, nothing else is going to change.
I'm Mo Headington, and I'm from Burridge, Illinois, in the western suburbs, and about
4 years ago, I was somebody who mobilized along with Dave Kraft, working with NEIS, on the potential for argon being on a very short list for nuclear waste, doing the research and development for nuclear waste reprocessing at Morris. And I found it very effective to go to village halls, city councils, getting resolutions, explaining it to them, resolutions of opposition. We prefer HASS, if, you know, given the choices that exist, versus transport. GNEP was the vehicle, and I know GNEP was zeroed out, but I also know that its name changed, and the International Framework on Nuclear Energy Cooperation, I think, or something like that. And I Google it every now and then, notice that they still hold meetings, and they have quite a following, because I think under Bush, 26 countries signed up and said, sell us reactors, and we were to take the waste off their hands. So I think that, I don't know if this has been brought up in any of these discussions, but it's not just our waste. And I mean, it's everyone's, but if the politics are such that, obviously the Bush administration's stand on it was adapted, or we would have done the same thing, Obama, because I think 5 or 6 more countries joined on. There's something like 31 of them, and then they have observer countries that are in the 30s or 40s for signing on to this. Can you shed any light on this international framework and where things stand with it?
I probably should turn to Steve Schwartz on this one. I'm not as well informed as I should be, but GNAP is not... yes, you're right, it's been zeroed out. I think, you know, there are continuing conversations, though, throughout the industry about how to meet energy needs. There is an international nuclear industry, and it in this country, because of the market forces and the costs, there are very large pressures to not build anymore. You know, it costs $12 to $18 billion to build one. The small modular reactors are one solution to it, and in a way, I suppose that's a kind of, you know, one of the kind of remaining remnants from GNAP. But it continues to be an issue, and it's, you know, I think there's some progress, especially if we can close some of the older reactors here. But, you know, unless we've got international partners on this, I think it's going to be a continuing issue. It still is, to some, an attractive way of going.
Yeah. Well, the partnership seemed to be one-sided, because we'd be taking the waste. They'd buy reactors and
right.
Companies,
well,
and
again,
we'd take the waste.
Right, exactly. Well,
yeah.
Part of the issue is we don't want to continue to promote weapons proliferation. So if there is, you know, weapons-grade material or enough uranium coming from those that can be diverted or reprocessed in a way that would make for a weapon, we'd rather not do that. So it's an international problem. It's almost better that we take it back, frankly, than leave it there, in my view, because I think we'll at least have the technology, and it's for some of the countries, more wealth to manage it. So we can ship it out, but it may come back to haunt us. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for being here. It's been a wonderful conference. I have a question that I don't believe pertains specifically to your expertise, but maybe someone else here can answer it. Over a year and a half ago, when Fukushima Daiichi had this terrible disaster, there was in the news, in the general media, reports occasionally about the extent of radiation fallout, both in the air and in the water. I haven't heard anything like that in over a year. And I have not seen any reports or any, even if any monitoring is going on to this day from that terrible incident. I know that, as I remember, there were statements about the fact that our West Coast was affected. I don't remember the severity of those apparent reports of how affected it was. And how much of that radiation contamination has shifted towards the east, even as far as this area of the country? Is anyone monitoring?
Yeah, there's a lot of this information on the Fairwind site. If you check, I wrote a book on this and it's a bestseller in Japan. So it's in Japanese though. So
it's not in English.
You know, when the accident happened, the day the accident happened, I knew there was a meltdown happening, and this is one of the fundamental turning points in my life. I had been an expert on Three Mile Island. And I saw my government cover up that accident. Radiation releases were probably something on the order of 10 to 100 times higher than what the NRC will still say. So I turned to Maggie and I said, "You know, I don't care what it takes. I'm not going to let it happen a second time." And that's really when we put the videos up on the site and things like that. But the issue is the authorities, whether IAEA or the Japanese government, have consistently underestimated the radiation. I was in Tokyo in February, and I was on the book tour, and I brought plastic bags with me. And every day I would walk outside and grab some dirt from where I was, and I ran. I came back with the dirt. Brought them through customs officially, you know, you have to declare dirt when you bring it back, and then sent it to a lab, and all five bags would qualify as radioactive waste here in the country, and this was on the streets of Tokyo. So, you know, what we would have to ship to Texas and store by our standards in Tokyo was ubiquitous. I was there again in August, and I was over on Niigata, which is on the opposite coast on the Sea of Japan, and it didn't get nailed by the plume so much, but the mountains between Fukushima Prefecture and Niigata are contaminated, and now their sediment in their rivers is loaded with radiation as well. In addition to the exposure people are picking up with their handheld inspectors and, you know, the devices or Geiger counters that people have, there's also a lot of hot particle contamination where people have ingested the material. We have cases where we have house dust that we're getting. People are sending us vacuum cleaner bags of dust. And one of the bags, which was examined over in England, it was 100,000 disintegrations per second in a 2-pound bag of dust. And that goes on, of course, for centuries. So the Japanese sleep on the floor. So the dust that's on the floor is in their lungs. And I am at the, based on my experience at Three Mile Island, I think over the next 30 or 40 years, we could see a million cancers as a result. I understand that that's an extreme view. But when you look at Steve Wing's work at TMI, I extrapolate linearly with that, I think we're going to see a lot of cancers. Right now we see an enormous, in Fukushima Prefecture, 40% of the kids tested have thyroid nodules. The normal number is 1%. The thyroid nodules are a precursor for cancer. So we're at the beginning of that experience, and it's alienating women especially and causing Fukushima divorces. I could go on about this. We'll talk out in the hall.
So you're saying that I can, at some point in the future, begin buying fruits and vegetables from California because over time the current level of radiation will be not
now
that
we're at a point in the U.S. Seattle and especially Seattle, but as far north as Vancouver and as far south as Portland, got nailed in March and April, and we've got good science behind that. We had air filters out in Seattle in March and in April, and they're called CAMs, continuous air monitors, and essentially you pull air through a cigarette filter. And then every day you take that filter out, put a new one in, and then you roll the filter out and you put it in a you lay it on an x-ray film, and people in Seattle wound up, and the rate at which the air filter was pulling air in was 10 cubic meters a day, which is about what your lungs breathe, and we were finding 10 hot particles a day from Fukushima Daiichi during March and April for Seattle. So yes, Seattle got nailed nowhere near what the Japanese got, maybe 1,000 times less. But at this point, you know, it's washed into the soil, and I'm not worried about what's coming from terrestrial sources here in the States anymore. I'm very worried about the top of the line, top of the food chain fish that are in the Pacific, and I don't think that's peaked yet.